Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. In that battle space, one of the people who is doing really important work, particularly as he's got the unenviable task, as far as I'm concerned, of trying to brace up the center left on matters of national security, and he does it extraordinarily well. He's Michael O'Hanlon. He is currently with the Brookings Institution, where he is a senior fellow with the Center for 21st Century Security. He has written extensively on the host of national security-related issues, including a brand new book entitled Healing the Wounded Giant, Maintaining Military Preeminence While Cutting the Defense Budget. Michael O'Hanlon, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Congratulations on the new book, and it gives us a lot of things to talk about at the moment.
Well, thank you kindly, Frank. Yeah, great to be with you.
Michael, speaking of a wounded giant, let me start with the news peg du jour, and that is that, as we're speaking, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, is appearing before what I imagine will be a rather unhappy set of legislators concerning a problem that none of us can take any pleasure in, namely that of the phenomenon of rising numbers, it seems, of sexual assaults, both of the heterosexual and homosexual kind, it appears. Is this evidence of a much more serious problem within the military, in your judgment, not just, you know, some breakdown of discipline and good order and all that, but maybe evidence of a real wounded giant, as you say?
You know, Frank, it's a troubling question and an important one, and I'm glad you asked it, even though I don't feel like I have a great answer. I would say, on the one hand, obviously, we need to take this very seriously, and the great increase in the number of reported incidents, even if it's primarily an increase in the number of reported incidents and not the actual frequency of the occurrence, we need to take it very seriously. And I think some of the proposals that are out there for various kinds of independent investigations and taking some of this out of the traditional military chain of command, disciplinary process, some of these ideas that are now being floated need to be listened to. And I'm listening to that debate myself and probably inclined to support that kind of a change. On the other hand, I also think it's important not to overstate the problem. You ask about whether this suggests that the institution itself is fraying. In terms of the indicators that I am more troubled by, not because I trivialize sexual assault, but because I think a lot of the increase there is because of a culture that's being more transparent and more open now. I'm more troubled by the suicides and by the families coming apart. And obviously, some of these problems could be interconnected. But I guess what I want to say is, yes, we do need some significant remedial action, but I am not necessarily of the view that this signifies a fundamental problem within our ranks. I think it's obviously a culture in which physicality, conditioning, appearance, so forth are emphasized even more than in our culture writ large. But that can never be an excuse and never should be an excuse for this sort of behavior. So I do think the military is going to have to, accept that it's going to come under increased scrutiny and going to have to make some changes, even though I'm not prepared to say the problem's getting worse necessarily.
Well, I wonder, Michael, if you could answer a question among the things that you've enumerated that we should be doing about this. I'm always bemused by the fact that it doesn't seem to be in that list by you or others, as it happens, the idea that maybe we ought to suspend the efforts that are being made to insinuate more women into more positions in the military, that particularly those that have even less privacy and therefore more opportunity for this kind of misconduct, and perhaps, homosexuals in the military as well. Does that not seem to be an obvious thing to do if this is a problem as it stands now, let alone what it might be if we exacerbate it?
You know, I don't know how to respond, Frank. It doesn't strike me as an unreasonable idea to raise. It's not one that I'm persuaded by myself. I think the two that you mentioned, the two sets of issues. Women in combat is one that I've spent more time studying and thinking about recently. And I spent some time in Quantico last year looking at the Marine Infantry Officer course and how they were allowing some women to attempt the course to see how they could do. And this was designed to be a way of providing some empirical data on whether women could get into the infantry or should be encouraged into the infantry. I came away from that experience of the view that it was probably a leap too far and too quick. And my thinking was, I did see some very impressive young women who attempted this course. None of them managed to pass it. There was only a few of them who tried in the observations I had. But I have no doubt there are a few women who are capable of this, but I didn't view it so much through the prism of the sexual crisis in the military today. I viewed it more through the prism of combat effectiveness. And also thinking about these women themselves and whether it was going to really be fair to them to try to break through this barrier. Now, obviously, they wanted that opportunity or they wouldn't have volunteered to take the course. But it led me to think that maybe we should be a little bit more incremental in how we approach that topic. And if we did have certain women who could meet all the physical standards of the infantry, that perhaps they should be first brought into the special forces where, you know, it's more of an individualistic community, and one or two or three or four or five women of special abilities who could be maybe Navy SEALs or Delta Force operatives, maybe that could be very effective within a special forces community and more easily welcomed. And then if that succeeded, I would have been more open to see the infantry ranks writ large opened up to women. That was my recommendation and something I wrote last November after these observations. You're probably smarter than I and thinking more broadly than I to be able to tie this issue to the current question of sexual misconduct. And there probably are some linkages, but I guess I don't necessarily have a strong view on how to link those issues. So I really focused on the combat effectiveness question.
Well, I just hope that it will be part of the debate, because it does seem to me that it's a logical first order question. And I've not heard it asked by those in the Congress at the very least and in the military. But we'll be watching that closely, as I know will you, Michael O'Hanlon, our guest from the Brookings Institution. You mentioned the Marine Corps and some of your observations there. As it happened, you had the opportunity last week, Michael O'Hanlon, to talk with the Commandant of the Marine Corps about this fraying as he sees it within his service and to some extent more broadly as well. What were your takeaways from his conversation and sort of more generally your sense of how do you maintain, as you put it in the subtitle of your new book, military preeminence while cutting the bejesus out of our defense budget?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when General Amos was here and we had the great honor of hosting him. I had a couple of impressions. One was that we didn't get a lot of discussion from either myself as the interviewer or from the audience about some of these issues of sexual misconduct. And I think General Amos is spending a lot of his time thinking about these, as, of course, he knows he has to, and he cares very deeply, clearly, about doing so. But I think, you know, it was a welcome respite to actually get to talk about strategy and the future of American military requirements. At least for me, it was nice to be able to have that opportunity. And I was glad that the people in our audience directed things that way. Again, not because sexual misconduct issues are unimportant, but because we don't want service chiefs to become so bogged down in those things alone that they can't actually think long term about where our military is headed. And you know, you're right that we were making some significant defense budget cuts, and now under sequestration, we're doing it fairly mindlessly. And so whether or not one ultimately believes in a certain level of defense budget cutback, and you and I are both a little more hawkish than some of the ideas out there, I would rather, even for people who are to my left, that's fine, but I'd like to hear them link the proposed cuts to strategy and capability. And then we can assess whether the cuts go too far or whether, if they are going to be made, they at least need to be done as part of a broader national effort at deficit reduction. Because to me, the only reason to cut the defense budget is to reduce the deficit and strengthen the economy so over the longer term we stay strong. But you can't do that on the defense budget alone. As you and I know, it's less than 20% of the federal budget. So if you're going to ask for reductions within defense, you've got to, I think, also look at reform of entitlements and taxes. And we don't see enough progress on those latter issues right now to make me very happy.
No, and I couldn't agree more with you on that, Michael. And sadly, while it's only 20% of the budget, as you know so well, it's bearing 50% of the sequestration cuts. And increasingly, people are saying that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future. This was not just a one-off deal. Congress seems to be locked into to perpetuating this. And I'll let you go with this last observation. I very much share your concerns about what we're doing that may not be obvious immediately. I worry, too, going back to what we were alluded to earlier, about sort of the condition of the military as an institution. And I'm listening to the Navy cutting corners by letting the grass grow to a foot on their facilities. And it really just seems to me this is setting up a totally different paradigm, whether it's the sexual, you know, preoccupations and difficulties, or whether it's the hollowing out of the budget, or, you know, giving these folks less than the equipment and the resources and the support that they need, that may break the only military we have. If that happens, it will be, I think, over your prostrate body as well as mine, Michael O'Hanlon. Thank you very much for joining me. Keep up the good work,
and
we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we're joined by Matt Brodsky, who will give us an update on Turkey and Syria right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.